Benny Hinn's favorite radio personality, broadcasting legend, Drew Marshall.
There's only one other singer I know who can get up in that range. James Brown and this guy. I just forgot his name.
James Ingram?
Yeah, James Ingram.
Oh, okay.
James Brown, James Ingram. You got to be James to get up there.
Well, who's the guy that used to lead singer for Earth, Wind, and Fire? One of those
guys?
Oh,
yeah. Philip Bailey.
Yeah, he's another one.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I think he actually surpasses. He can get crazy up there.
Yeah. Geddy Lee's got a pretty high rate.
True. But there's a real reason I want this song being played before our next guest. Because it's kind of her name. Her name is this name. That's right, Yama Brown. Close enough, isn't it? Why are you looking at me like that?
Well, the Yama, B part.
Yama B.
Yeah, okay, all right. But now that she's
doctor.
I figured
every time she's been interviewed on a show, they throw in, you know, they started with the James Brown. So why not be a little different?
Yeah.
Let's find out if she's okay with that. Dr. Brown, how much of an idiot am I?
That was actually awesome. I love James Ingram.
All right. Thank you very much. I just thought...
And I love that song, because people always think it is named after me.
Thank you. I'm here all week. Enjoy the meal. Well, I had the privilege of interviewing your father in the same year of his passing, and... It was a pretty cool thing. It was a dumb move for me to go out and see his concert and then interview him right after his concert, because I was a little gobsmacked. I don't get tickled by...
Oh, my goodness.
I don't get tickled by many people, right? But when you see him in concert and then you're interviewing afterwards, I was a little dopey. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that, because I have just been saying how much I miss going to one of Dad's concerts. It's been, obviously, forever, but I never... You know, it's such a good feeling and such a good, you know, remembrance of my childhood and just growing up, that it's like one of those things never gets old, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, when we sat down in the suite upstairs, and by the way, you know, he made me wait 2.5 hours.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so sorry for you. What's he doing his hair?
Yes.
Well, you know what? Don't feel bad. He did that to Donald Trump at Trump Plaza in Atlantic City.
Why would you
want to see him after the show?
Why would you worry about
Denzel Washington? So you're in great company.
Why would you worry about your hair before meeting Donald Trump? Like, you know. Made any sense.
It was part of his ritual, you know?
Well, it was funny. I was sitting there in this suite and with my recording engineer, and we were, you know, waiting and falling asleep. It's about 2 a.m. And then all of a sudden the door opens up and in comes somebody, and then in comes somebody else, and then Mr. Bobbitt, and then a lady, and then a makeup lady, and then a hair lady, and then Mr. Brown, and then a couple of other ladies. And it was crazy, man. It was just crazy. And then, so I want to play you a little clip. All right, here's a little clip from that interview. Have a listen.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, when I was living in Australia for 5 years.
God bless you.
And I was pastoring in a church there. And when I came back to Canada, some people... who knew me as a younger fella, when they found out I was a pastor, they just about flipped their lid. They couldn't believe it.
I can't believe it either. God bless you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
You remind me of, you know, your face, you got the same resemblance as Tom Selleck.
There we go. Okay. That's all I wanted,
you
know, right there.
Not quite
as James much. Brown said I look like Tom Selleck. Come on.
That is great.
You know, it's funny when I talked to his publicist or manager or whatever afterwards. I can't remember who it was, but she said, "Well, how did it go?" And I said, "No, it was great. It was a lovely time." And you know, we sat down and talked for almost half an hour. And she stopped me. She said, "You talked for half an hour?" I said, "Yeah." I said, "I'm sorry. Is that bad? Did I break a rule?" She said, "No, but I don't think he's sat down and given a half hour interview to anyone ever. Do you know of that?"
Well, he has given interviews that long, but, you know, usually there's a break involved for sure. But, you know, that's pretty good, though. So,
yeah.
You know, I mean, he usually doesn't talk for too long, especially if it's interactive.
Yeah,
Now, you might get a 30-minute interview with just him talking, but I don't know how many questions you're going to be able to ask.
Well, it was, and you know what was interesting was during that interview, his body language changed. Everything changed as soon as I told him that I used to be a pastor. And there's something, maybe you can help me understand this. There seems to be something. It was the same thing when I was talking with the Blind Boys of Alabama, with Mr. Clarence Fountain. There seems to be something with the older black generation that really has a respect for clergy or ex-clergy, that sort of thing. Do you think that's true?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's not... God is very close to that, and he felt like his gift and what he had to give to the world was definitely by divine intervention. So he didn't think it was by chance, and he had a tremendous respect for anybody that was in the pulpit or, you know, a man or woman of God. So, you know, we grew up in the church. He grew up in the church, got a lot of his, you know, screaming and things like that from old Southern Baptist preachers, and... We, you know, the church was very much a part of our lives. I mean, it was interesting going to church with him, to say the least, because, you know, part of the time it was about keeping the attention on the pastor and away from him. But, you know, it was great when we did get a chance to go, because Dad just, you know, he loved the Lord and definitely instilled that in us.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, what did you have for breakfast this morning? Did you have some cornflakes with bananas by chance?
No.
Okay.
No, but my son probably did. He takes after his grandfather for sure. He loves those cornflakes and bananas. I can't do it.
Okay, just wanted to check. So again, I don't know if I've got my facts right here, but you're one of nine children that I think your dad was a daddy of. Is that about right? Did I get the math right?
Yes, yep.
Okay, so five sons, Teddy, Terry, Larry, Daryl, and James Joseph Brown, the second. Yourself, Deanna, and Venetia. Is that right?
And actually, you're missing three other ladies that have come up since Dad passed, so I don't know if we have enough time to go into that for this interview, but...
okay, but hold on.
For another one.
But my point is... Is that weird? Is that weird for you being one of so many?
You know what? It isn't, because I tell you, the six of us that grew up kind of as his children and the ones that were obviously named in his will, which three boys and three ladies, three gentlemen and three ladies, I should say, we still all knew about each other. So even though there were half brothers or half sister, because Deanna is my full sister, we still knew about each other. So it still kind of was home. I mean, my mom was the second wife. She still invited Venetia in, you know, my brothers in from, you know, the first marriage. So it wasn't like we were all strangers. It didn't kind of get weird until probably after Dad passed, you know, with so many other children that kind of came up after the fact. But no, I mean, Papa was a Rolling Stone and, you know, what can you say? I mean, the ones that I grew up were mostly from his marriages, his first and second marriages, but there were a couple that weren't. But, you know, we still all loved each other. Still the same.
I want to play you one last clip. I hate to make this all about, you know, me and my interview with your dad, but I want to play one more little clip here, and then I want to get your response to this. Have a listen.
Okay.
Hit you've taken.
What's the hardest hit you've taken?
Just hurt you the most.
When I lost my dad. Anything else I can deal with, man, stuff. But when I lost my dad, I couldn't bring him back.
When was that?
87, Miss Bobby.
Somewhere.
Yeah. Those kind of things we don't like to remember. If I ask him when he lost his mother, dad, he goes,
So your dad there, you know, I asked him, what's the thing that's kind of hurt him the most over the years? You know, the biggest hit he's ever taken. He said losing his daddy. Did you know that would have been his answer?
Absolutely, because him and Pop were tremendously close. I mean, when Grandma Susie, his mom, was no longer in his life, I mean, Pop was all he had. His father was all he had up until Pop went into the Navy. So he kind of felt comfort, you know, in that being kind of like having a single dad raising you and then have to go off to war, and then you're kind of left to fend for yourself, but he still loved his father very much. And they had a tremendous relationship, very close up until Pop passed away. So it doesn't surprise me that, and it's kind of ironic because I feel the same way. I mean, I feel like 2006 Christmas morning was like, you know, almost like my death, because it was a whole part of our lives that just, you know, drastically changed. We thought that would probably live forever, you know. You, people say that, but you really don't think anything is going to get them down, you know, after being having so many ups and downs. But I'm not surprised.
Okay. All right. Well, that was, I mean, that was sort of the follow-up question for me, and you answered it already, you know, with the passing of your dad. What kind of a kick in the guts was that? And, you know, it was the biggest thing. And my goodness, let's just talk about that. You know, even just that Christmas time, I mean, the day before Christmas, I mean, what the heck happened with you and Darren, right? I mean, jumping, you know.
Oh, my goodness. It was a very emotional time going on in our family. Words can't even describe what we were going through as a family and what I was personally going through. But
I got to correct myself. This thing didn't go with you. And by the way, did you call him Chip or Darren?
Oh no, I didn't call him Chip. Everybody else did because he, you know, kind of gave himself that nickname.
Oh, who gives themselves a nickname?
Stand for Christ has incredible power, which I have to give my hats off to him for, you know, kind of thinking that that was something that, you know, was his nickname and kind of giving him strength. So, you know, we all have our own thing.
Yeah, got our own thing. Okay, but it wasn't the day before Christmas. It was the day before your dad's funeral that you and Darren kind of. So, okay. I've got so many questions. There's not enough time here.
I know.
You know, I want to ask you who you think killed Darren. And I want to ask you why. And I, you know, was it a robbery or whatever? And I've read a lot of stuff on this, doing some research before this interview, and I kind of already come to the answer. Now, you tell me if I'm wrong, but nobody knows because there's just too many suspects.
There you go. Bing, bing, bing. Darren was not doing business on the up and up. I mean, that was kind of what was going on.
Let's be a little more straight up about this. Darren was a D-bag.
Well, he was when it came to business, that's for sure. When it came to a husband, he was probably pretty close there. When it came to a father, not so much, but the suspect list could be very long in that regard. And it just, you know, that was a tough time for me because Darren and I were no longer together. We were divorced during that time, but I still have two little kids. I had a 6 and an 8-year-old that just lost their father. So it made that blow just, you know, just too much to bear a couple of years after losing my father. It was a lot.
You have had to endure more stuff than you were designed to endure. Why? What? I mean, you can't be, you know, there's some people, I wonder if they're a magnet for so much garbage. But do you ever look upwards and go, okay, enough already, God?
Oh, of course. I mean, definitely when I was going through it, I felt like that. I mean, to lose that on Christmas morning and, you know, get into a fight, a knockout, drag-out fight with my husband right before I buried my dad. You know, I had to bury with all these bruises, my cornea, you know, shot, and I mean, just all these things going on, then to go through a divorce and find out I had lupus. I mean, you're talking about so many things going on in the course of a couple of years. I definitely felt that. I felt like, what is going on? But, you know, and we tend to question it while we're going through it, but it was only God's, you know, faith and grace for me. I mean, his grace to me and my faith in him that got me through that, because I knew that there had to be something better. I knew that there had to be light in the tunnel, and no reason in the world why I would have gone through having this, you know, tremendous man like James Brown, who I learned so much from with his roller coaster, you know, life of ups and downs, that he was triumphant over it all, and I could be too. So I just kind of pull from that strength and learn from him.
Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown, produced by someone named Michael Jarg. I don't know who this person is. Monday, October 27th on HBO.
Mick Jagger?
Oh,
you
I don't know who the.
I was gonna say, you don't know who Mick Jagger is.
Well, I've been told I move like him.
You got those moves like Jagger.
Yeah, baby. I'm looking really forward to this. I don't know. I might actually be looking more forward to October 27th on HBO than the big movie that came out in the theaters. And that thing, whew, how'd that do? It did all right.
You know, it was kind of slow to get those numbers up, but eventually it got there. And now it's, you know, releasing internationally. It'll be doing that through March. But I got to tell you, for somebody that has seen both, and I've had a chance to see the documentary at Tribeca Film Festival, and it's outstanding. You know, I actually got to see that before I got a chance to see the finish of Get On Up. And I just thought, what movie in the world could top this? I mean, with Dad talking through it and, you know, really, really close friends. I mean, you're in for a treat. It really goes into the civil rights, the political, just the man, you know, behind it, and really gets into the funk of what he was doing with music. So it's tremendous. I can't wait for it.
Can you explain to all the awkward white guys listening right now what On the One is?
You know what? It's that half second a little bit sooner than you get ready for that music. You know, when you're going one, he's already one, two. You know, he's already done the one before you even get to one. So it's so quick, it'll make your head turn around and you just go crazy. But it's funny because seeing him in rehearsal and seeing him hear things, you know, a man who never learned how to read music and it came just from his heart and his soul, seeing him in rehearsal with all his singers and musicians and just come to life, I mean, it's nothing like it in the world. I really miss it. I really do.
I remember, I think I read a quote where your dad said, something like, when you go to concert, go to one of my concerts, it's like doing church. I want you. True. You may come in here with burdens, but I want those burdens lifted by the end of it all.
Right. Right.
And I got to say, there are very few concerts I feel completely lifted out of the funk. Well, out of the junk into the funk. to sound like an awkward white guy. Then, you know, Blind Boys of Alabama, I keep saying them because, you know, your dad was friends and fan of Clarence Fountain and the Blind Boys. And, you know, that was it, man. I go to about 40 concerts a year and I've never had the feeling that I had when the same thing, you know, from being at your dad's concert, just something else.
Oh yeah. I mean, the energy was just so dynamic and just so wonderful that you definitely weren't going to be sitting in your seat
No.
at the end of the night.
No.
You know, he was going to make sure you were up and jamming. And he always said, you know, I'm going to have clean music that, you know, people from 8 to 80 can come and see. And that was his biggest pride in his music. I mean, it got you out of your seats and dancing, having a good time. And like you said, you know, your worries just kind of went away, if nothing, for those couple hours while he was giving you the hits, giving you the funk.
Mr. Charles Baba, is he still around?
He is. You know, matter of fact, I just saw him not too long ago because Bobby Bird was inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame posthumously just this past weekend. And I was there with his wife, Vicki Anderson Bird, and Mr. Bobbitt was there. So, yeah, he's still around, still kicking.
I actually really like Mr. Bobbitt. We had a few good conversations. He's pretty straight. I mean, he's, you know, lead, follower, get the heck out of the way kind of guy.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely.
All right, I want to ask you some questions that we asked on our show over the last couple of weeks. And I want to get your opinion on this because this is what happened on our show. I keep saying this awkward white guy thing, but we had three awkward white guys sitting in studio talking about these issues, and it was just dumb of us to do so. So let me ask you this. Being a black woman who has grown up with abuse and married into abuse,
mm-hmm.
with story after story of celebrity men beating up their partners,
mm-hmm.
why are women with these men in the first place? Why don't they leave before it gets to this? Are they really trapped? I mean, What's going on with these men that make them do this anyway? And is there some kind of weird? By the way, these are 37 questions in one, so just bear with me.
I was going to say this is loaded, so I don't know where you want me to start, but I'll take a stab at it.
Okay, is there a connection between black kids getting whooped with a switch? Right, NFL's Adrian Peterson has been charged with child abuse for injuring his son, hitting him with a switch. Black women getting whooped by their men, right? NFL's Ray Rice knocking out his fiance, in the elevator. Chris Brown beating Rihanna. And black men being gunned down by the cops, right? Michael Brown, unarmed, shot and killed by police. So there's the awkward white guy things. We were sitting there asking this question. In other words, are white cops more concerned for their safety when dealing with the black community because of their experience with highly emotional and violent black men? Help rescue me out of this conversation.
Well, I tell you what, there's definitely a feeling of violence at some area in growing up. Because I tell you, if you grow up in a family where abuse is kind of handed down with switches and things like that, and that grows up to be your norm, then it's kind of accepted, right? Or you kind of feel like that is the way that maybe love is shown. I mean, even though it may not feel good being whipped, they'll tell you this is for your own good, or, this is so you understand, or blah, blah, blah. And when it comes to women, and I'll just cut to that, there's so many different things. I mean, from a woman, I can really speak from my point of view. It's not like when I got into the relationship, it was just, let me beat you up first thing I do. I mean, of course not. There's a time in there where you have great parts and you have, good things that go on in the relationship. And for me, it was kind of hoping for those things to kind of come back. This person will show their better side or sweeter side at some point. And also because so many marriages, whether black, white, or indifferent, end in divorce, I was a product of divorce and was so not wanting that for my family, was trying to break the cycle. That to me, that was the goal. I wasn't even thinking about the fact that, idiot, you're in a relationship with someone who doesn't even care about your feelings or anything like that, because they're going to abuse you at every chance they get, whether it's verbally or physically. So unfortunately, I was caught up in that and saw it at a young age, thought it was a part of the culture, thought it was a part of the marriage and the way that people just dealt with things, that I was to say was okay. Is it okay? Absolutely not. Is the violence in the homes okay? Absolutely not. But I do think that there's a continuous feeling of anger and a violent nature in the community, in the black community. But I want to say something about that, because, with domestic violence and violence in the homes, it doesn't have to do with being black, white, or indifferent. No socioeconomic background has anything to do with it. I mean, you're talking about 1 in 4 women, not black women, not Asian women, not white women, not Latino women. It's 1 in 4 women that either have dealt with it themselves or have dealt with someone in their immediate family that's, has had to deal with abuse. So it's very rampant in our environment, in our communities. So unfortunately, it's in these celebrity, these celebrities, they don't, I always say that the NFL and players, different athletes, and it's not that I'm saying it's not their fault, because people have to be responsible for whatever they do.
Right.
But they need to be taught, to sit up there and say, okay, and I feel this way strongly, you put your hands on a woman, you deserve to be punished and all that, which is true, because somebody can lose their lives. And that's the thing, you want to get this stopped before you have another death or another homicide in relation to this. But it's so important for these guys to get help and training and learn how to deal with this anger or coping skills or whatever, because if you don't do that, it's just going to happen again, and there's just so many reasons that why women change. I mean, stay. They stay because of fear. For one, because that person has either threatened them or someone in their family and say, if you leave, I'll kill somebody. I mean, that happens a lot. Financial reasons. People stay for less, for less reasons. But financial reasons, absolutely, because that person is going to feel isolated. They're going to feel like they can't, survive or maybe take care of their kids. There's just numerous reasons not to make excuses. But going through it and being a part of it, and thank God I'm here to tell the story, but that's what I try to say to young kids and young women and men, is that this could be it. This could be somebody's life. You know, you get involved in this situation, and this could be, you know, a man gets so upset that he does something, and that's the end of his life because he has to go to jail because he made a rash decision. Or, you know, a woman is just so afraid to step out and thinks it's okay that she stays in this bad situation, and next thing you know, she's dead somewhere. So we have to break the cycle. It has to be, you know, people like myself who, you know, people might look up to, celebrities and all this other stuff. You have to say, it's not okay. You know, you have to step in and say something when a family member may have gone through something and you want to, you feel like you got to make a change, or you have to say something to help that person. It's just about doing it. We don't do it enough in our own community, and I want to say that in the African-American community, but we don't do it enough in general, you know, because we're too afraid in getting involved in other people's things. And it's just unfortunate that there's not more love and healthy relationships than there are these, you know, these other type of abusive relationships, because they exist in all different areas of life.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Yama Brown, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, my goodness.
Preach it, girl. Preach.
I just about said four times, you go, girl, but I couldn't get in there to say it.
I'm so sorry. You know, I take after my dad. I'm very passionate.
No.
You know, he had some ups and downs, but I tell you for sure, you know, I just learned so much from him. And that was one part of my book that I just wanted to come across, because for all his fans all over the world, I didn't want it to make it seem like I was just completely bashing him, because I wasn't. But in order for me to tell my truth, I had to tell the whole truth. And unfortunately, yeah, it had an ugly part to it. But it was who he was. And, you know, we're all flawed. And so I still love him regardless of all of that. You know, he still is my dad. And I terribly miss him to this day. Sure.
What's the weirdest story in your book? What's the one story that most people want to bring up with you?
Michael Jackson.
Yep.
I knew you were going there.
Stop.
And it's so funny because I just feel like, you know, of course, Michael was a little weird to all of us, I think, in some instances, but it was his way of showing his respect to that, and he wanted to be in his presence for as long as he could, and we just kind of left it at that, but it was a little weird. Him asking to be there all that time.
Yeah. So my engineer's looking at me like, what are you talking about? So Michael Jackson requested to be alone with James Brown after his death.
Mm-hmm.
And how long were they hanging out for?
About a total of 5 hours. It was actually in two different times. He came in, and, you know, by the way, that was his first time back in the country since all of his trial. And he came in and he asked to go there. We got the call and we said, absolutely, he can go. And he went in there with, you know, entourage of people and people and the funeral director and, you know, whatever. And then he left. That was about an hour or so. And then he came back. Well, he called again and said he wanted to come back. That was a couple hours later. And he stayed there for quite a bit of time and actually put everybody out of the room so that him and dad were just in there alone. And I always said, I think he probably took some hair or something of that. We'll never know, though.
I can't even talk about it. Okay.
See?
Well.
See?
So, listen.
Everybody makes it into something weird. But
I know.
If that was his father or something, we would have just let it go.
I know.
So,
listen.
Let it go.
I grew up in the funeral business. I grew up in a funeral home.
Oh, my goodness. You never wanted to just stay with the corpse for hours.
Well, no, you know, it's so weird you're bringing this up and we're talking about this, but I felt, see, this will cut Michael some slack. I felt the same way when my mom died, and I was able to do that because my dad was the funeral director. And so it was our funeral home where my mom was in the casket with, and I just wanted to be by myself with my mom, right? So,
yeah.
What are you looking at me like
that for? I understand, because I spent a little bit of time with dad, not quite as long as Michael, after dad passed in the hospital. And I felt that overwhelming sense of just wanting to have him, even though he wasn't alive, to myself, because I knew not too far from now I'd have to be sharing him with the world again. So I get it.
He said that he and Al Sharpton recorded a gospel album, but it never got released. Do you know that?
Yeah, that's what they tell me. I wasn't there when they did it, but I'm sure they probably did. You know, Rev, as we call him so affectionately, I mean, he was like a brother to us and a son to my dad. So they spent so much time together. I think they did record an album, but I don't know why they never released it. There's so much music of dad's that still hasn't been released that we still have to. So who knows? Maybe one day.
Well, I don't know what it is about. Well, I let's see. How do I say this? I've got to let you go here. I'm sorry for taking so much of your time, but you're just so stinking easy to talk to. You just seem like a buddy. You know, you remind me of who's that Oscar winner that we had on the show? I can't remember her name. She played Benjamin Button's mother.
I'll look it up while you talk.
Yeah,
that's who. Oh my goodness! I know who you're talking about, but I can't think of their name.
You guys have the same laugh.
Oh my goodness, that's so funny.
No, and you're just fun. You just sound. Anyway, hey, listen, have you remarried?
I haven't remarried yet. I'm engaged. I'm actually not in a huge rush. You know, when I first got engaged to Darren, my dad told me, he said, you can stay engaged forever. He said, don't be in any rush to get married. So I'm kind of listening to him now.
I love it. I love it when you impersonate your dad. It is just the funniest thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he definitely gave us some good advice. And so I'm just trying to go along with that. I mean, there's nothing wrong. I just taking my time and just want to make sure it's right.
Yeah. How about Taraji P. Henson? That's who I was thinking of.
Yeah, that's exactly who it is.
Yeah. Oh, Taraji. Oh, my God. Isn't she such an amazing actress?
She
I've never
good.
Had the chance to meet her, so I don't know her at all, but she would be cool if I ever get a chance.
Yeah, she's as fun as you've been today. Folks, the book is called Cold Sweat, My Father, James Brown, and Me. Yama Brown, by the way, I just want to talk about the doctor thing in a second, because that's just crazy. Yama Brown reveals intimate details about her family, both heartbreaking and intriguing. She offers a raw portrait of what it was like to be daddy's little girl to a drug addict, egotist, wife beater, and one of the most legendary musicians of our time. Man, this is a fantastic read. It just seems to be a little ironic that a guy with a drug problem has a daughter who's a pharmacist. Just saying.
Well, you know, he didn't take prescription pills.
Right. Okay.
he did not like going to the hospital or the doctor or anything like that, which was unfortunate because he did suffer from high blood pressure, diabetes, and he was even diagnosed with prostate cancer at one time. So he didn't like taking prescription medication. So, you know, the thing about the doctor with me and the whole pharmacy, he just felt like, I mean, he really pushed me with education. I knew I wanted to get my doctorate. Medicine really intrigued me. I had to do something that wasn't entertainment, you know, just kind of chart my own path. And he said, I have a doctor in the family. We need a doctor. So I became the doctor in the family. And it was interesting because anytime anything medically related, he would call me, make sure either I was there with him or whatever, because he didn't like anything that had to do with medicine. So,
okay, final thing. I keep saying final thing, but you're just okay. This is really the final thing. You don't have anything. Okay. You don't have anything more important to do than talk to me right now, do you?
Actually, I'm watching my daughter's softball game, but that's okay.
Oh, good for you. That's funny.
I can see it.
You know,
so I'm good.
One of the first times I interviewed Larry King, he was at his son's softball game, so you're in good company. Okay.
I'm good.
Do you have a public opinion, and can you say anything publicly on the record, first time ever, maybe you've done it before, about Conrad Murray?
Oh, I haven't said anything about him.
Because you know, there are a group of people out there that are very angry with him saying he killed Michael Jackson, and there are another group of people out there that are saying, no, Michael Jackson killed himself, and he paid Conrad Murray just to, you know, be a supplier or whatever. Bend the rules a little, maybe. I don't know. Who knows what went down? But, you know, would you want Dr. Conrad Murray taking care of your dad?
No.
Okay.
Mm-mm. You know why I wouldn't? And I'm not going to, because I don't know his practice other than obviously what happened here with Michael. But I can definitely say that someone that doesn't have enough sense, and I'll say this because especially from a professional standpoint.
That's what I'm asking. You're a pharmacist.
You, Right. From a professional standpoint, if you know that you're not an anesthesiologist and you're going to administer propofol to someone, you don't think enough of that person to make sure that you're trained enough or that somebody around you is trained enough to monitor their whole body systems while they're on this medication. You're asking for it. You're asking for something like this to happen, and this is the direct result of it. It's not surprising to me that this is what happened, because there has been such a long history, had been, of Michael using propofol, you know, through his tours and things like this, that it would finally catch up. But it was negligence. It was complete negligence. And the fact that, you know, Michael was pushing him to do what Michael wanted him to do. So in that respect, you know, I guess the doctor is going to take the money and kind of, you know, half do what he's supposed to do. But I just think that it was twofold. You know, unfortunately, Michael was in a position that he felt like he needed this, and he was, you know, addicted to this type of behavior, and that was unfortunate that he couldn't get out of that. But Conrad Murray didn't have to take it that step further and be a part of his addiction or his abuse. And he really was negligent, and I don't think he got everything he should have gotten behind that. But
well, you have been a gem. Folks, the book is called Cold Sweat, My Father, James Brown, and Me. Dr. Yama Brown produced the major biopic about her father, Get On Up, directed by Tate Taylor of The Help, by the way, starring Chadwick Boseman. James Brown Family Foundation.org. James Brown Family FDN.org is a website you want to go to as well. What else am I flogging here? They've got keychains, frisbees, Mr. Dynamite, The Rise of James Brown, produced by Mick Jagger, Monday, October 27th on HBO. I really wish you and your family the best. I really, really do.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And, you know, I want to say one final thing. We are working on turning Dad's home into a museum, the home that, you know, I partly grew up in. So I'm hoping that soon, very soon, fans will be able to come to good old South Carolina and see where Dad ate those cornflakes with bananas.
Yama, it was a real pleasure. You're a real treat. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. You guys have a blessed day.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Yama Brown, daughter of the Godfather soul James Brown, on the Drew Marshall Show. That was a lot of fun. A short break, and when we come back, it is live on the Drew Marshall Show. This week's recording artist. Sorry. Tim just hurt himself again. Evan Champagne. evanlive.ca. This guy is good. But to be honest, he's not as good as this guy. Mr. James Brown on the Drew Marshall Show.
I'm back. Get up off of that thing and dance to you better. Get up off of that thing and dance to you. Sing it now. Get up off of that thing and dance to you better. Get up off of that thing and try to release that pressure. Get up off of that thing and shake the you feel better. Get up off of that thing and shake the you. Say it now. Get up off of that thing and shake the you feel better. Get up off of that thing and try to release that pressure. Get up off. Good God. So good.
To find quality guest speakers these days. If they're interesting, they're usually expensive. And if they're cheap, they're usually boring. Well, here's someone who's both expensive and boring. Drew Marshall is a high school dropout who tried to become a pro football player but didn't make it. He then tried to become a firefighter and didn't make it. Now he's trying to become a stand-up comic. Good luck with that, Mr. Marshall. But if you're looking for someone who's unpredictable, incredibly honest, provocative, genuine, then we've got the right guy. Everyone seems to be an expert on something these days. Why not book someone who's an expert on nothing, except how to be brutally honest about yourself and your faith? To book Drew Marshall as your guest speaker, go to drewmarshall.ca.